WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new movie adaptation of Last Exit to Brooklyn, the 1964 novel by my guest Hubert Selby Jr. Last Exit is a collection of stories about hoodlums, hookers, drug addicts, and transvestites. The characters are brutal, their stories are hopeless. Selby said he was trying to portray the horrors of a loveless world. Although the novel is now considered an urban classic, it was shocking and controversial when it was published. Time magazine called it Grove Press's extra special dirty book for fall. Last Exit was the subject of a major obscenity trial in England. It was banned in Italy. In America, an editor was arrested for having published one of Selby's stories. Hubert Selby has written other novels, but his first remains the one he's best known for. The movie is directed by German filmmaker Uli Edel. Selby was a consultant and stayed on location for the shooting. I spoke with Selby in May when the film had its U.S. premiere. The movie continues to open in more and more cities around the country. The stories in Last Exit are set in the slums around Brooklyn's waterfront, where Selby hung out in 1949.
Well, it was at the time as the New York port of embarkation. They used to call it the Brooklyn Army Base. And it subsequently has been closed, and it's now being turned into office space. But that operated all through the Second War and the Korean War. And tons of troops and material and equipment was shipped from the Army base overseas to Europe. And, of course, there was a lot of Navy personnel there as well. And it was like any neighborhood waterfront area. There's a lot of violence, just an incredible amount of violence.
Were you ever beaten up when you were living in that area?
I never lived in that area.
You're just hanging out there.
Yeah, just hanging out. And was I ever beaten up there? No, I don't think I was.
I figure you were probably fairly weak at the time because you had TB when you were a little bit younger. And as a result of the TB and some surgery that they performed on you in an attempt to cure the TB, you were probably in a weakened state. And I was wondering if that left you in a position in which you were easily picked on, if it left you in a position where you felt likely to be victimized.
No, I wasn't a weakened state. I mean, I had 10 ribs cut out, and there was nothing left but an oil slick. And I was actually in between hospital stays when I was down there. But I don't think I've ever been picked on in my entire life, to tell you the truth. I may have felt like I was. I think every kid does in school or so forth. But I don't know that I've ever been picked on before or after the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But I had no problem when I was hanging out down there. As a matter of fact, I think what happened and what had happened in other areas after the surgery was that people tend to take care of me more. They look out for me. So rather than pick on me, they kind of protect me.
The film was shot on location.
Correct.
How had the neighborhood that Last Exit to Brooklyn is shot in changed from the time that you wrote it?
Well, we didn't shoot it in the neighborhood where the book takes place. That neighborhood was unavailable. And the other neighborhoods, I don't know how much they've changed because I've never been there before.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspect that, like most neighborhoods around there, the big change was ethnic, where many years ago, when I wrote the book, it was basically an Anglo-Saxon Italian neighborhood. It now was a lot of black, West Indian, Puerto Rican neighborhoods. But basically still, I think, the same.
The film is directed by a German director. Is there anything that he wanted to know from you about that period in American life, or that period in your life, or in Brooklyn?
Everything.
Uh-huh.
We went from Los Angeles to New York in December of 1986. It was Uli, the director, Barrett, the producer, and Barrett's associate, Herman. And we drove around the old neighborhood, I guess all day Sunday. We went there on Saturday and Sunday, and then we came back. And I rode to New York with Uli, so that gave us maybe 6 hours on the plane, 5 or 6 hours on the plane, talking constantly about the book, about the neighborhood, about the people. We talked a lot about the music and the source material, and then the same kind of conversation over the entire weekend while in New York. And he just obviously needed and wanted to know everything possible about the entire environment and the area and the era in which this takes place.
I think one of the best-known characters from your novel is Georgette, who you describe as a hip queer. He's a homosexual, but often dresses in drag and is described as a she in the book. Who is the character based on?
Well, there was a young guy named Georgie that lived in the neighborhood, and I didn't understand my relationship to Georgie at the time, but I realized subsequently that I had a very deep and profound affection and compassion for Georgie, and in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing the book. And that came about to anticipate a question. I wrote the first part of a section of Last Exit called The Queen is Dead. I wrote the first part of that story, and I called it Love's Labor's Lost, and that was published in the Black Mountain Review. And a year or two later, I met someone from the neighborhood, and they said Georgie had been found dead in the streets, literally in the gutter, and evidently died of an OD. And as I said, I didn't understand the emotions behind this at the time, but I knew I had to finish the story. I could not allow Georgie to have died, especially such a humiliating death, without doing something for him. I had to give him I had to dignify his life in some way. And I mean dignify, not romanticize. And so I finished his story, and as I was doing that, the concept for the book developed. So in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing Last Exit to Brooklyn. And when they suggested I play the role of the car driver in the movie that hits Georgette and kills her, it just seemed absolutely perfect for me because, and it seemed poetic too, that I would be, in a sense, killing Georgie when I brought Georgie to life in the book and then subsequently on the screen, and that finally, hopefully, Georgie can be put to rest and find the dignity that all life deserves.
Did any readers assume that you were either gay or a transvestite after reading either the story, The Queen is Dead, or Last Exit to Brooklyn?
As I understand it, most people assumed I was gay. And also, my friend of mine told me a very interesting story. He was talking with a black friend of his, and he said that this friend of his assumed I was black because I had depicted black people so well. So I guess I'm a black, gay, homosexual queen or something.
I had heard from someone that your publishers wanted you to pose with your wife just so readers would know he's not a homosexual.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten about that. I think somebody interviewed me and suggested that we do that, have a picture in whatever magazine that was. And if I remember correctly, I said, no, that gay people buy books. Let's not scare them off. I'd forgotten that. That's true.
So they went for that, huh?
Well, whatever. I mean, I don't know, but they went for it or not.
There's no redemption in the book in the sense that, you know, people don't see the light and change their ways and so on. In fact, some of the most interesting people are the ones who get killed. But each chapter of Last Exit to Brooklyn starts with a quote from the Bible.
The Old Testament.
Were you religious at the time you wrote it?
Not in the sense of organized formal religion, no.
But in another sense?
I think of it more in a spiritual sense, not a religious sense.
Mm-hmm. And Christian?
Hmm?
Are you a Christian?
Oh, am I a Christian?
Yeah.
As far as I know, no.
Okay.
I have no intention of being one.
And has that sense, that spiritual sense, but outside of organized religion, increased or decreased as the years have gone on?
Well, I don't think it can increase because I think we're nothing but spiritual beings. But my awareness of it and my conscious contact with it has increased.
Mm-hmm. Hubert Selby Jr. is my guest, and I want to ask you, now that I'm reintroducing you by name, your nickname is Cubby.
Correct.
How did you get the name?
Well, I'm not sure, but when you have a name like Hubert, and you're playing on the streets of Brooklyn with Vinny and Mikey and Tony, and they look at you and say, Hubert, Hubert, you know, you have to do something to survive. And at one point when I was maybe 10 years old, or not area, someplace, I was on a team called the Bear Cubs. And the only connection I can see between the nickname Cubby and some event in my life is that. So maybe from that came the name Cubby. I don't know, but I am eternally grateful. And maybe the only reason I survived my childhood was eventually I got to be called Cubby instead of Hubert.
Hmm. How did you start to write? You dropped out of high school.
Well, I don't know if I went to high school.
Oh, really?
Well, I did finish the ninth grade. I guess that's high school.
My neighborhood, it was junior high.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, I left at 15. I started to write because I was taken off a ship in Germany when I was 18. They said I couldn't live more than 2 months. And I've been given up for dead many times. And I just didn't want to waste my life. I had what I now realize was a spiritual experience. And what happened was I knew that someday I would die, and just before I died, two things would happen. Number one, I would regret my entire life. And number two, I would want to live my life over again, and then I would die. And that terrified me. As I say, it was a spiritual experience, and you know, as you know, those experiences are far more profound than any experience we can have at this level of consciousness. And to think that I would live my entire life, look at it, and say, oh, I blew it, was such a terrifying thought that I bought a typewriter. I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I bought a typewriter because I had no ideas or anything else. But that is what got me to start writing, was I did not want to waste my life. I wanted to, and I had to do something with my life.
Well, writers like Richard Price have credited you with giving them the sense that the stories in their neighborhood, that the language that they and their friends used could be the language of literature. What gave you the idea that your stories and the kind of street language that you used or that people around you used could be the stuff of literature?
Well, when I started to write, I knew I had to write about something I knew, that I couldn't just invent a whole new thing like science fiction or whatever. I knew that that wasn't my area, my shtick. And I was just guided and directed from, again, this inner source, this, you know, this creator of life, whatever it is that exists within all of us. And I certainly didn't define it as such at the time, but everything else was put out of my mind, and my mind only focused on certain things. And so every night for the next 6 years, I came home from work, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. Some nights I'd get one word, some nights two words. But every night for 6 years, I worked on this book, and that was the only thing that was given to me to write, was those experiences.
What kind of job did you have at that time?
Oh, most of those years, I worked in an insurance agency. I calculated and administered pension plans and group insurance plans.
Were you any good at it?
Very, very good.
What kind of family did you come from? Were they poor, middle class?
Middle class. Of course, you know, I was born just before the Depression. And I had nothing to do with that, believe me. It wasn't my fault. So I don't know what kind of middle class there was from 29 to 39, you know. But whatever it was, that's where we were.
So you dropped out of school when you were 15 and you mm-hmm. went to work on the waterfront. Why did you drop out?
I was as restless, irritable, and discontent. I couldn't stand it. I just couldn't stand it. And I also knew I could never succeed in school. It terrified me. I knew I didn't have whatever it takes to go to school. And in many ways, that's true, I didn't. I couldn't do it. I had to go. I had to go.
So you went and you worked on the waterfront. What was the experience like for you, and were you exposed to the kind of violence and corruption that you've written about?
Not really. I wasn't. It was a job. You know, I worked on tugboats. I worked on launches. I worked on dredges, and then I went to sea on Liberty ships. And I wasn't exposed to it in that sense. And I loved it. I've always wanted to go to sea. If I hadn't gotten sick, I might still be going to sea. I just loved it. I loved everything about the water.
Well, when you were 18, you signed on to a freighter. And that's when you got tuberculosis, right?
Well, actually, I had been sailing on freighters for a couple of years at that point.
I see.
I started, I guess I was 15 or 16 the first time I sailed to Europe. And it was just after my 18th birthday when I was taken off the ship in Germany.
With tuberculosis.
Correct.
Now, if I have this straight, the therapy that they used for you, because you were very sick, was the doctors deflated one lung, took out part of your other lung, and then removed 10 ribs. Why did they remove 10 ribs?
Well, they cut 8 ribs out on one side to collapse that lung permanently. And they cut a couple of ribs out on the other side to cut the piece out of the lung. And they had used an experimental drug to keep me alive. And that impaired my vision and my hearing, and my inner ear was almost totally destroyed, and I couldn't walk. I'd fall down, and all my muscles were petrified from the drug. So it was kind of a mess.
Was this all experimental therapy at the time?
No. The surgery and everything was not experimental. It was, you know, one of the few ways they had of dealing with a situation as advanced as mine.
So you've been permanently weakened, I guess, by the experience, but lucky that you survived.
Yeah, I'm a survivor. I'm tenacious. I've had 4 different doctors in the last couple of years say to me that 2 doctors in Germany and 3 doctors here in this country have said to me that according to all accepted medical evidence, I'm a dead man.
Huh. You got hooked on morphine from the hospitalization experience after the TB and the surgery?
Mm-hmm.
Were there any medical precautions that were taken, you know, so that you wouldn't get hooked?
Well, you can't prevent it, but, I didn't leave the hospital physically addicted. I just fell in love with the stuff when I got it in the hospital and eventually found it on the streets.
How did you kick?
Oh, it was really very simple. I got arrested, and they strapped me down in solitary, and I quit my habit.
So you kicked in prison?
Not prison, just a jail, county jail.
Still must have been pretty excruciating.
Well, it was very unpleasant.
Was anybody kind to you while you were there?
Yeah, nobody was unkind. Yeah, the system, of course, is a drag, but there was nobody was nasty to me or anything. And again, you know, I just kind of have a way of finding the biggest, strongest murderer and becoming friends with him, and nobody bothers me.
Really? Is that the trick?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what's the technique?
I'm not sure. It's just some inner thing of survival that allows me to kind of smile the right smile and talk the right talk. I have a way of knowing what goes on inside of people, and I can appeal to that.
Is this something that you've done not only in prison but outside of prison, you know, to kind of get the right protection?
Oh, well, not consciously always to get the protection, but to talk with people with their language about their life, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because that makes people comfortable, and they respond. They respond to you.
How did the publication of Last Exit to Brooklyn change your life?
Well, I guess the big thing, at least from my point of view, is that some money started to come in and I could just dedicate my life to drinking and other aspects of chemical warfare. And I finally drank myself to death and I found another way to live.
Excuse me, you found another way?
Another way to live. You know, I finally drank as much as I could and I couldn't drink anymore, and I ended up getting sober, and I just entered another phase of living.
How have you made a living in the past 25 years in addition to your books? You've also had jobs.
Oh, many jobs. I worked in gift shops and gas stations and offices. A couple of years ago, I was on welfare. I was a single parent and had been sick for a few years. I couldn't work, so I was on welfare for a year. So I just whatever I need to stay alive.
When you're working in gift shops or gas stations, would you often get recognized by people who knew your writing and wondered what you were doing there?
Not in this country. No. Never.
Did you often wonder what you were doing there? Did you wonder why you had to be doing this?
Oh, absolutely. I wondered. As Riley used to say, what a revolting development this is. I don't know how I end up where I end up. It's remarkable.
Some bio of you says that you had written for the National Enquirer for a time. Is that right?
Well, I was working there. I didn't exactly write. They had a mail order thing for a while. And a friend of mine was the head of that, and he gave me a job kind of writing copy for, mail order, like underwear and stuff, that kind of. So.
Do you remember any of your copy?
Oh, ladies, this trico underwear. I don't know. You know what I mean? I don't know. Things like that. I had that a few weeks, however long.
Well, in the past few years, one of the things you've done is tour with people like Henry Rollins of Black Flag, the hardcore group, and you perform with Lydia Lunch,
right,
who's a punk singer. What kind of affinity did you feel with them and they with you? I mean, they're a lot younger. They were part of punk rock.
Well, they sought me out, actually, and they had been reading my work. And I remember it was amazing, talking with Henry about it. He had read all the books and really understood them. And I just instantly liked the guy, for one thing. I met him a couple of years ago for the first time. He's an extremely bright, sharp young guy. And he has a huge heart. He also has a little confusion like the rest of us. And we hit it off very well. And so we did a few gigs in L.A. And then last March, we did a tour of Europe together. And it was terrific. I mean, I get to meet a whole new world of people that I never met before. Because most of the people that come to see Henry, and they're like under 30, those people. A lot of them in their teens. So I meet people that I would never have met except under those circumstances.
You've been teaching lately, right?
Yeah, except I don't really call it teaching. I have a fiction workshop in the graduate school at USC. And I go down there one night a week.
Mm-hmm. So when was the last time that you were either on welfare or working at a kind of job that you really didn't feel you belonged in, like, the gift shops and the gas stations?
Oh, a couple of years ago.
That recently?
Yeah. When I was working for a job that ended, I guess, in the end of 86 or 87. Yeah, the end of 87. So I guess since then I've just been home working, writing. Yeah.
You writing something now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And Hubert Selby Jr. is the author of Last Exit to Brooklyn, and he was an advisor and has a cameo in the new movie version of the book, which just opened. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And let me ask you, should I have been calling you Cubby? I mean, do you still not like the name Hubert?
Oh, no. Now it's home. Now I like it.
Now you like it.
Yeah, but 50 years later.
Okay, well, thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.